Hello and welcome to the latest Money and Politics podcast. This episode is focused on my 2023 summer reading list. Now, looking out the window, and I'm recording this on Thursday the 17th of August, and you can see that the summer is nearly gone, if not gone completely. However, I'm still going on my holidays next week, so hopefully this will be still relevant to a couple of people. I did publish this online a few days ago. Now, the purpose of this list is, I've been doing it for about 6 or 7 years now, is that I put together a couple of books, normally 8 or 10, all with a political theme, mainly looking at Irish and then European and global politics. But it all have a very much a public affairs, current affairs and politics angle. So we might as well get straight into it now. So the first one is The Murderer and the Taoiseach by Harry Magee. Now, a lot of people will know Gubu, and I have a fair idea where it comes from. It's a political term to indicate a scandal or something that's particularly lurid or whatever, and it comes from the famous how he quotes during the infamous press conference when Malcolm MacArthur had been found in the home of the Attorney General. And Gubu stands for grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented. And normally I would do that in a high accent, but I have a bit of a sore throat, so I'm not going to attempt that. I think the phrase was actually coined by Conor Cruise O'Brien from his then Sunday Independent column. But anyway, Harry sets out a lot of the background to this, but looks obviously less so at the crimes and as Malcolm MacArthur, though he does obviously set out the story there, and it should not be forgotten in the retelling of any of this story that there were two very innocent victims of Malcolm MacArthur. MacArthur had savagely and cruelly killed Bridie Gargan and Donald Dunn, all as part of his almost Walter Mitty-esque attempt to commit a bank robbery, and bank robberies were all the rage back in the early 80s. So Harry Magee paints the picture of what they call the long hot summer of 1982, but also the political summer, the political angst that was going on at the time. You'd had a series of general elections, or was part of a series of general elections. Here you had the Attorney General, a very erudite and highly respected lawyer, Patrick Connolly. Connolly happened to be a family friend of MacArthur's. He had no hand in it. There was never any insinuation that he had anything to do with this or that he had any knowledge of it. And that Malcolm MacArthur had asked to stay in his house. And little did Paddy Connolly realise that Malcolm MacArthur was the subject of the Garda's very intense manhunt that was going on at the time to find the killer. So as a political journalist, Magee naturally focuses on the political implications of the scandal, a scandal that ultimately led to the collapse of Haughey's government. It's a very well-paced, very exciting telling of a very, very exciting story. Magee is an excellent writer. It's not his first book, but this is thoroughly enjoyable. I might disagree with some of the stuff around the portrayal of Haughey. I think maybe a little bit unfair. But it is an extraordinary, because I think if you remember back, or people of a certain age, and that includes myself, will remember back that one of the points that Haughey made during that press conference, the Gubu press conference, was that one of the people he would immediately look to in the middle of a crisis like this would be his Attorney General. And his Attorney General, Patrick Connolly, was clearly involved in this, so he couldn't be the person he goes to. Now, as far as I remember, Connolly had actually, things had got so bad, and Connolly was so taken aback that he had actually decided to head off on a planned holiday to New York. And the government had decided, no, you need to get back here. Just kind of told the story of a government in crisis. By the way, if you want to find out more about Malcolm MacArthur, and he's an extraordinary figure who had gone from a wealthy Dublin socialite, I think he'd inherited God knows how many millions, but which he had gone through at a very, very quick pace. He was seen to be a connoisseur and a patron of the arts around Dublin. I highly recommend Mark O'Connell's A Thread of Violence. This is based on O'Connell's series of interviews with Malcolm MacArthur. And I think the blurb on the book very accurately describes the resulting book, saying that it is a haunting and insightful examination of the lies we tell ourselves and the lengths we'll go to preserve them. And I think that can give you a very good sense of how those interviews with Malcolm MacArthur went. The next book is also a biography of sorts, or a chronicle of the events of a particular age, and it's actually around the same time, because this one is Sean O'Driscoll's Heiress, Rebel, Vigilante, Bomber, a profile of Dr. Rose Dugdale. And it's, maybe biography is the wrong word for it, but it's certainly a fascinating account of the English heiress turned IRA volunteer. Now, some of you probably watched the recent documentary series on RTE, The Heiress and the Heist, which talks about her role in the Alfred Bice theft of the famous artworks. But this book, its focus is less on Rose Dugdale's actions and more about her, her upbringing and her experiences after prison. And it is an attempt to look at the person herself. Because what you saw from the documentary was that she had come from a very wealthy background. I think her father was a stockbroker and a very wealthy one. Maybe aristocracy is putting too strong, but they were certainly part of the upper classes. And it tells the story of how she rebelled not only against her upbringing, her class, and ultimately her country, but even tells a fascinating story of her time in, I think it was Oxford, where she was one of the first females to get into an Oxford union, having dressed up as a man, how she had broken various conventions, how she was constantly looking for a cause, and that she had this desire to side with the victim. And as the book progresses and as her story progresses, we become fascinated by the fact that this need to side with the victims never seemed to occur to her that she was somebody who was creating more victims, despite her clear academic brilliance. O'Driscoll has painted a fairly non-judgmental, three-dimensional portrait of this complex person. And whatever her views about Dugdale, and by the way, Rose Dugdale is still alive, and I think she did cooperate with him with this book. The book itself is a fair and detailed story of a remarkable life, even if you don't regard her as a particularly extraordinary person. It's a fascinating telling, and I think it's well worth reading. Next book, it's not a biography. It talks about an issue, and talks about particularly Irish defence. And it's Is Ireland Neutral by the Irish Times' Conor Gallagher. And in my blog, I say this is very much a personal choice, and it is, because I think this is an important contribution to to a much-needed public debate on Irish defence policy and Ireland's role in today's world. No, I don't agree with every point that Conor Gallagher makes. Indeed, I would disagree with one or two of them. For example, the core tenet of his book seems to be that Ireland's traditional policy of military neutrality is, and this is a quote from the blurb rather than from the book itself, in fairness, is a vague, flimsy and elastic notion that Irish governments have been happy to stretch or in some cases abandon. Now, there's elements of truth in that, but I think overall that's an unfair characterisation. But I do accept that for a long time defence has been seen as being the sleeping policy dog which the department would prefer its minister not to kick. And that's not just the Department of Defence, that's the Department of Foreign Affairs as well. And from my own experience of the Department of Defence, there are a lot of really good, very, very committed policy civil servants there who are driven by the best of motives. But I think the culture within the Department of Defence was to see itself very much so as a supplicant, not just of the Department of Finance, but also of the Department of Foreign Affairs. And that's something where, if there is not a political impetus, it tends to come to the fore. And I think the current debate on Irish defence policy is maybe highlighting that, but nobody's discussing it. Now, I come to this with a very definite view. I favour keeping the triple lock mechanism and overseas deployments, and I cannot see why we would have a high-level policy debate on defence when our defence forces are chronically understrength and suffering a massive retention and recruitment crisis, not dissimilar to the one that's happening in the Gardaí. Indeed, I would suggest that the Gardaí are about 12 to 18 months behind where the defence forces are in terms of political neglect. And this is political neglect that isn't the fault of this minister or the last minister. This is a decade-long process. And that's why I find where you have certain politicians saying that we should be considering NATO membership, maybe we should crawl before we should walk, before we should run. And I think anything that isn't focusing on the implementation of the Commission on the Defence Forces report is a waste of everyone's time. But that said, Gallagher is actually really good in putting forward the arguments. I don't agree with his underlying suggestion that our policy of military neutrality means that we must sit back in the face of the aggression and do nothing. I don't think that's the history of it. Certainly when you look back to Frank Aiken and look back to the early 60s when our important role is played in this part of the non-aligned countries. And indeed, I should recommend to people, and I have the link in my blog that accompanies this podcast, that I would recommend people to read the short essay by Roger McGinty, who offers an effective counter-argument to this view and who highlights the important role for non-military aligned countries who can be peace entrepreneurs, and the key role in Europe for countries like Ireland on this. but we have to be able to walk the walk, and that means we need the defence forces. And Gallagher argues very strongly for that, that we need to grasp that the traditional idea of warfare is changing. Indeed, it's not changing, it has changed. Warfare now expands to include cyber attacks, environmental concerns, election interference and disinformation. And therefore, as Gallagher makes the strong case, and I think this book is an important element of why we need to re-examine our response, look at our capacity, both in terms of policy and the allocation of resources. Next book on my list is a political handbook, actually a political guidebook, and actually an essential piece of kit for anyone thinking of getting into politics. And it's Win Every Argument by Mehdi Hezan. Now, anyone who knows Mehdi Hezan knows that he's a political commentator and pundit with a reputation for loving a good argument. And his book is a superb guide to debate, persuasion and public speaking. All too often we see our political leaders trying to avoid arguments and coming out with these bland statements, fearful perhaps that to be seen as being argumentative is a negative in the public perception. But Hezan makes the counter case, and he makes it extremely well. He puts it across that a good political argument made in good faith with respect for the other side, where the two distinct and opposing viewpoints have intrinsic value. And this helps us to develop our politics, because arguing helps us solve problems by uncovering new ideas we might not have considered. And by the way, arguing can also be fun, where both sides have wit and where the moderator, particularly kind of on radio or on television, whether the person hosting the debate or hosting the discussion, has the intelligence and the cop-on to keep their interventions to a minimum. Now, Hezan offers very practical advice, talks about tried and tested tips, talks about how he approaches debates and interviews, and how he approaches his media encounters. But in many ways, what he has managed to do is a modern telling or a modern reapplication of the ancient Greek and indeed slightly Roman art of rhetoric, an art which Aristotle defined as the faculty of observing in any given case the available means of persuasion. And that's what this book is about. It's about how to make your case most effectively and most persuasively, and how to deal with the other side. And I think from that, any person thinking of getting into politics, I would regard this as an essential piece of kit. The other piece of kit which I would regard as essential for anyone thinking of getting into politics is the follow-on from that, from the art of persuasion, the follow-on from the art of argument. And that's dealt with really, really well by Stefan Derink in his book, Inside the Deal, How the EU Got Brexit Done. Because just as any aspiring politician must understand the art of argument, they must also master the related art of negotiation. And Inside the Deal is Stefan Derink's well-written, very accessible account of how the EU dealt with Brexit negotiations. Now, Derink is well qualified to talk about this, not only because of his own experience and his own background as a diplomat, as a EU official, but because throughout this whole process, he was a close aide and trusted advisor to Michel Barnier, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator. So Derink was in the front row of the negotiations. And through this book, which is not a heavy read, it's actually, given the density of the subject matter, it's actually a surprisingly easy read. He explains how possessing clear and defined objectives, along with the advanced planning and essential a careful attention to detail, helped the EU to achieve its strategic objectives in its negotiations with the British. Now, he doesn't make any judgments on the Brits' approach. He doesn't make any judgments. There's no kind of lecturing down to anyone. But you can see by extension that the Brits went into these negotiations without a clear definition or a clearer sense of, number one, what the negotiations could achieve, and number two, what their objectives were. And that's what comes across, that the EU had very clear objectives, strategic objectives. It had an understanding of what could be achieved through negotiation. It had an objective of what they call, from the Harvard rules, the BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And they had realized that there was no best alternative, that negotiated agreement was the best way to go. And the Brits had this bizarre notion that they could have a non-negotiated agreement, or they could have their hard Brexit and just walk out. And I think that, and while that was their public position, I think there was a slowly dawning realization within the British establishment that that didn't exist. But that didn't inform their negotiation strategies. Now, there are judgment calls by me, which in fairness, Derink does not attempt to get into in the book, so I'm going further than he goes. But I really would recommend the book as a really good, sound explanation as to why anyone who's thinking of getting into politics be that locally or nationally, needs to understand the art of negotiation. They need to understand the interests, concerns, and the needs of the other party with whom you're negotiating, especially when that other party maybe doesn't fully understand it themselves. Excellent book, highly recommend it. Next issue moves from Brexit to something that's slightly related, and that's Brendan O'Leary's Making Sense of United Ireland. Now, if there's one book on this list which I believe is an absolute essential, it is this one. And I can't describe it, or I can't offer a greater tribute to it than Andy Pollock's review in the Dublin Review of Books, who said that O'Leary's book, quote, should be required reading for everyone, including unionists, anyone who is interested in and concerned about the fate of this island. And he's absolutely right. Brendan O'Leary, who is a long acknowledged expert and academic on the history of Ireland and its most recent history and modern history, he sets out his position in the opening chapters of the book, stating that the book does not demand Irish reunification, but then adding, but it does expect it with a high degree of probability by 2030. But the important thing, and I think people who are maybe citing O'Leary's book for the wrong reason, they seem to omit his very careful caveat in the next paragraph, where he makes a point that demography is not destiny. And therefore O'Leary sets out not so much an 8-stage process, but there are 8 headings where he looks like what he believes should happen and may happen over the years from now to 2030, and examines it under 8 headings. These include how reunification may happen, lessons from elsewhere, which is a very, very important factor, the economics of reunification, and more importantly, how a reunified Ireland should accommodate diversity. Now, this is a deeply serious piece of work, and it's one that many of us believe should have been undertaken by the Irish government. Now, clearly a white paper on unity wouldn't be as readable as O'Leary's book, particularly his near conversational prose style, which makes it very, very readable, but gives us a base document for the work that the Irish government should be undertaking. And whether you believe in unity or you believe in Northern Ireland's part in the United Kingdom, I think it's an essential piece of work for everyone to read. The one thing O'Leary makes clear from the very, very start, that everything he talks about, all his arguments, are rooted in the Good Friday Agreement and in the principles that underpin that. Now, the next book is a return to a biography, but this one is an American biography. It's Richard Norton Smith, a very long acknowledged academic and a presidential historian, and it's his biography of Gerry Ford, An Ordinary Man. Now, I remember reading a book years ago, and I can't remember, Steve Reeves, for some reason, is the name that pops into my head at this very moment, which was an early attempt at a biography of Gerry Ford. It's quite a light book. And it was based on Gerry Ford's observation that he was a Ford, not a Lincoln. But the particular thing I remember about the book was the dust jacket on it had a cartoon of Gerry Ford dressed up as an 8-year-old with a little beanie hat, etc. And he was sitting on the knee of the Lincoln Memorial. And I thought it was a very, very good point. And it also shows that Gerry Ford's self-deprecation. Problem with Gerry Ford, and maybe in the public mind, is that we tend to think of him as this caricature, as the butt of LBJ's famous joke that Gerry Ford was so dumb that he couldn't fart and chew gum at the same time. That, by the way, is a very cruel jibe, as Ford was one of the few Republican congressmen who consistently backed Lyndon Johnson's civil rights legislation. LBJ, however, was famous for the Easle Bon Mows, famously claiming that one of John F. Kennedy's aides was so inept that he wouldn't know how to pour piss out of a boot if the instructions were printed on the heel. Now, Smith has produced a detailed and highly favourable biography of America's only unelected president. And that's the point that people maybe omit. Gerry Ford wasn't elected president. He wasn't even elected vice president. When Nixon was elected for his second term, his running mate was Spiro Agnew. And just around the time that the Watergate saga was breaking, Spiro Agnew himself was in trouble with issues about tax fraud. Well, during his time as as governor of Maryland, and insinuations that he was taking backhanders. So just before Nixon's resignation, when though Nixon wasn't considering resignation in the early stages, people around Nixon realized that Nixon resigning would leave with Spiro Agnew as president, so it'd be frying pan into the fire. And therefore, when it came to replacing Spiro Agnew, Spiro had to resign, Nixon chose exceptionally decent Gerry Ford. Now, Smith portrays Ford as an underrated leader who had a great willingness to make tough decisions and whose personal decency and that ability to take decisions and not worry about the consequences certainly look an awful lot better with the passage of time. Ford infamously or famously gave Nixon a pardon. Now, that seriously hit Ford's popularity ratings very early on in his presidency. But Ford had no doubt that this was the right thing to do, as was the only way that they could move on from Watergate and that the country needed to move on. Now, it's not a light book. It's not a small book. Frankly, you're not putting this into your suitcase to head in the holidays, because this is 850 pages long, but maybe 830. But it's a vastly entertaining read, as Smith chronicles many of the key moments in the brief Ford presidency, from his handling of the post-Watergate crisis, how he rebuilt some confidence in American politics and in the White House, to his handling of America's final withdrawal from Vietnam, and to Ford's embrace of economic deregulation long before Reagan, and his support for what they call the far-sighted Helsinki Accords, which ultimately led to the breakup of the USSR and the collapse of communism. It's a really well-written book. It is something you can dip in and out of, but should be read from start to finish. Now, the final book on my official list, and I have a semi-official list that comes up in a couple of minutes, is Serhii Plotkin's The Russo-Ukrainian War. Plotkin is a Harvard historian who's from a Ukrainian-American background. It's probably fitting that my summer reading list have what I think will become the definitive book on the biggest crisis facing Europe in terms of mainland crisis. That's Putin's invasion of Ukraine. He's unashamedly personal in it because he comes from a Ukrainian background. But his position as a highly respected Ukrainian historian gives him, and his family connections with people who are on the ground still in Ukraine, gives him a very particular insight and an inability to explain the invasion and to put it in the context of Ukraine's history and its relationship with Russia. So this is a contemporary history written in real time by an actual expert. Now, it offers valuable insights into the origins of the conflict and its international ramifications, and he dares to look a little bit forward to what happens in post-conflict and does imagine such a world. Most importantly, the book very early on explodes the myth that Putin's invasion of Ukraine is due to some kind of Western provocations. And he sets it in the historical context, an old-fashioned Russian imperialism. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend you read it. Now, I've got five other books. I'd like to just look at the list again. It is five, yeah. I have five other books that aren't on my list because I haven't read them in detail. Well, I've kind of dipped in and out of two or three of them. But the books that I really want to read, and if I had been on top of my reading list earlier on this in the summer, one or two of them probably would have made it into the list. So it starts out with a very personal choice, and that's Terry Galway's Frankenal. Now, the subtitle on this one is a long mouthful. It's FDR, Al Smith, and the Unlikely Alliance That Created the Modern Democratic Party. Now, for the uninitiated, Al Smith was a famous Irish-American politician of New York in the 20s. He became governor of New York, and he was a contemporary of FDR's. Indeed, they kind of come up on the same side, both Democrats, both reforming Democrats, but from very, very different backgrounds. Al Smith was from the tenements, from the slums of New York, had worked his way up, had gotten involved in Tammany Hall, had started out as a porter in the fish market in New York when he was about 13. As a Tammany Hall politician, you'd be seen to be corrupt and accepting backhanders, and Tammany Hall was the famous Irish political machine that ran the Democratic Party in New York. But along with a few others, Smith showed himself to be a real reformer, and his track record as governor was one of housing reform, clearing the slums, starting the projects, and more importantly, statewide of labour law reform, of setting a maximum working week, getting rid of child labour, and setting much higher standards within particularly the garment industry in New York. And Al Smith was a great reformer. He ran for the presidency. He was the first Catholic to run for the presidency. I think it was 1928. Now, his run was set for disaster from the start, but he was very much a forerunner of John F. Kennedy, and his story is a fascinating one. I've actually, over the last couple of weeks, I've been watching a couple of videos on YouTube and some documentaries about Hal Smith, and also about Mayor LaGuardia, who was the famous mayor of New York, who would be almost a contemporary of Smith, and looking at both their reputations as reformers, as really big figures and people who left a massive legacy. Now, Terry Galway's particular book looks at the relationship between FDR and Al Smith, looks at how two men who had similar ambitions and similar goals, but whose personality drove them apart. And it looks at how they fell out and how Al Smith, in many ways, when FDR became president, although FDR was turning Al Smith's New York record into the federal national record, that Al Smith actually fought FDR the whole way through and opposed FDR, not because he opposed his policies, but because he opposed him. And there's a certain degree of personal bitterness comes into this. By the way, Al Smith ended up finishing up as the chairman of the company that built the Empire State Building. It's a fascinating story. Terry Galway's portrayal of New York politics is brilliant, and I would suggest reading any of his books. Next book is maybe fits back into the category above where I talk about Make to His Hands book and Stefan Drinks, which is a really good guide for people thinking of getting into politics. And it's Alistair Campbell's But What Can I Do? The subtitle, which is Why Politics Has Gone Wrong and How You Can Help Fix It. And Campbell, through his podcasts and through his recent writings, is basically kind of putting a plea for popular involvement in politics, why you need to have mass membership political parties, and why people on the ground need to get involved. And it's a very practical guide. It's written from his views of what he's seen happening, not just in the UK, but because he's acted as a political consultant, a campaign consultant across Europe and across the world. It's a very, very good guide as to how people should get involved in politics, how they can get involved in politics, and why modern politics needs a lot more involvement by ordinary people. Going back to Brexit and to Brendan O'Leary's book on Northern Ireland, I think an important book that should be read after those is Professor Tim Bale's The Conservative Party After Brexit, subtitled Turmoil and Transformation. Bale has been the effective historian of the modern Conservative Party, and he looks at the turmoil, he looks at the Murray leadership, the Liz Truss, Boris Johnson, and now up to Rishi Sunak, and looks at the turmoil that's been on there. And kind of deviating slightly from a book review and looking into current events, I was thrilled the other day, or I was not thrilled, I was happy to see Leo Varadkar flag up the idea that Ireland does have a view, and that the Dublin government does have a view on what's happening in Northern Ireland, and does have concerns about the slowness in the return of Stormont, and does have a concern about the DUP dragging its feet on returning the institutions. And I think the point needs to be made that Dublin has to start driving this process. That we know from experience post-Good Friday Agreement that things go wrong in Northern Ireland when the two governments are not on the same page. And it's not that the two governments are not on the same page now in the way that Boris Johnson and Liz Truss were bad actors and unhelpful actors in this process. But the degree to which I think the current Tory party, or the leadership within the Tory party, and certainly the Northern Ireland Secretary, and maybe the British Prime Minister, they've shown that they're willing to move stuff on the Windsor framework. But Northern Ireland isn't a priority for them. And that Dublin has to drive this and has to get it home to London. That Northern Ireland must be a priority. The return of the institutions must be a priority. And I think Tim Bale's book is a good way of understanding what's happening in the Tory party at the moment and why Dublin has a big, big hill to climb on this one. But because it's a big hill to climb doesn't mean they shouldn't be attempting to do it. And therefore I welcome Leo Varadkar's comments on a Plan B. I just hope that they're followed up with something and that we don't see a classic Varadkar announcement followed by nothing. Now, let me turn very, very briefly to the last two books on the list. So the first one is Syria Betrayed by Alex J. Bellamy. And it's the subtitle of it sums it all up, Atrocities, War, and the Failure of International Diplomacy. And Bellamy, who's a noted expert in this area, basically just chronicles the absolute mayhem and tragedy that is Syria. And that how bad international actors and this kind of the enemy of my enemy is my friend has led to a horrific situation in Syria, and that not everything is as black and white as you would like to portray it. So that's not to let Assad off the hook, but to say that it is because of the action of international actors and the failure, as he points out, of international diplomacy that Syria has descended as badly as it has. And the last book is by Marianne Mazzucato and Rosie Collington, and it's called The Big Con. Now, the subtitle will give it away: How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies. The book looks at the big five consultancy companies and basically says since the 70s, 80s and 90s that governments have been far too over-reliant on them. Now, they blame neoliberal strategies in big governments across the world, but they also ensure the degree to which governments are basically been risk-averse and are having franchising out decisions to the consultancy companies, and how the consultancy industry is really not capable of doing this, and indeed that the Chinese walls that we believe exist clearly do not. It's a fairly controversial piece of work, and I think there's actually some of this is based on a recent Australian case where one of the big five consultancy companies, there's been a lot of challenges and a lot of political controversy over the fact that it was consulting, it was been invited in to help the Australian government in redesigning some of its tax laws, and yet how that company's clients were finding out about this, although there were non-disclosure agreements and a whole lot of things built into the consultancy contract. So, I mean, for people who are looking at how government operates, quite frankly, maybe the stuff is a little bit conspiracy theory, but there's still a basis to it. So anyway, so that's my list. That's my full official list and my supplementary list. There's plenty of material there. I hope you get a chance to get away and read some of them. And certainly this is not stuff that's confined to just reading on holidays. I think a lot of these books are things that where you're not going to read them necessarily from cover to cover, but you're going to find yourself dipping in and out of them over the period. So I would strongly advise people to get some of these onto the bookshelves, or certainly get down to the library and have a look through them, because I think they're well worth it. So that's my latest podcast. I'll be, as I say, I'm away for a couple of days, but by the very beginning of September, I intend to come back with two or three podcasts looking at the issues coming up, because certainly the next 3, 6, 9 months in Irish politics are going to be very, very defining ones. So enjoy what's left of the summer, and I will talk to you again very, very soon, but I'm not going to specify when, because so far I've missed every deadline. Anyway, take care and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.